Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who have fought more clearly and with, I think, greater effect about the nature of this war for the free world than our first guest. He will be joining us for two segments, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Kenneth Abramowitz. He is, by day, if you will, a manager of a very successful healthcare venture capital fund. But he spends, it's not just nighttimes, but about 2 days a week in public service, notably as the founder and driving force behind a terrific website, SaveTheWest.com, and as chairman of a group called Citizens for National Security. And it is in these two capacities that he has been prodigiously productive in helping government officials and private sector individuals and community groups and people across the country, typically with about 100 presentations, interviews, speeches, and the like per year, to understand the character of the free world, the threats to it, and what we best do to try to help it prevail. Ken Abramowitz, it is a distinct pleasure to have you on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Great to be with you.
So you've thought about this, as I say. You've dissected it. You've helped explicate it in a lot of different ways. How would you like our audience, which is, I think, reasonably conversant with the general problems, but how should we be thinking about the threats to freedom and whence they come, as well as what we should be doing about them?
Okay. Well, let me just start off with 1 minute of philosophy. There's two ways to organize a society, top-down and bottom-up. If you go back into history, 500 years, 5,000 years, everybody was top-down. There was a king. Everyone listened to the king. And at certain times, the king was not only the king, the secular king, he was the religious king, so to speak. He was in charge of whatever the religion was at that time, or some paganism. And everybody listened to the king. And if you disagreed with the king, off with your head. That's traditionally how society's been organized. Then, in the beginning of Western civilization, 3,800 years ago with Abraham, and then 1,800 years later with Jesus, came the rise of the individual. And people started to say, wait a minute, society is to benefit the individual, and the king, so to speak, works for us. The government works for us. And then, of course, in our founding documents, we the people are in charge, and the government is our servants.
The ultimate bottom-up operation.
That's right. And so to me, everything that's going on is a battle between the old form of government, namely top-down, and the new form of, I'm talking historically new form, namely bottom-up. And according to my calculations, approximately one-third of the world population is living in a country that's bottom-up, and two-thirds are living in a country that's top-down, also known as a dictatorship now, and or a kingdom. And to me, it's a battle between the two-thirds and the one-third, and the two-thirds have us outnumbered, so to speak, and we're battling for our intellectual lives and political lives, we the one-third.
Yeah, maybe even our physical lives, for that matter, depending on how this thing plays out at the hands of some of those top-down types.
The two-thirds want us either physically dead or culturally dead. So there's two forms of warfare. I mean, there's more than that, but in generalities, there's two forms of warfare, and we have some idea how to fight physical war. We have no clue how to fight cultural war, and that's another one of our dilemmas.
Mm. So let's talk about the physical war just briefly. I think we're all reasonably familiar with it, but of course it takes various forms in the current world, doesn't it? It's it's old-fashioned army against army, and then you've got lots of people who are subnational groups that are also able to wage physical war. Some call it jihad, some call it revolution and the like. How are they faring at the moment in terms of posing threats to the free world?
Well, if you look at the physical war, first, we do have to look at who's our enemy. I have a joke sometimes when I give talks. I say to the audience, who's our enemy? And the irony is, if I had asked that question in 1942, people would say, Germany and Japan, have you been sleeping, buddy? Excuse me, something wrong with you? And if I'd asked the question in 1955, I said, who's our enemy? You'd say, Russia? Hello? Nuclear bombs? Explosions in the air? Now I ask the question, who's our enemy? And I have a joke to senators, go out on the street, interview 10 people on the street, ask them who the enemy is. People have no clue who the enemy is, or they have different clues, but they don't see the full picture.
So who are they?
Oh, it's amazing that you would ask that question. So I divide our enemies into three categories. One would be physical enemies, with which there's no negotiation. It's a war to the death, and they're going to win or we're going to win, and that would be ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and hundreds, maybe thousands, of affiliates around the world, and under different names. But let's just say non-state actors, commonly called ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
So this would be a group specifically, I think of them as sort of Sharia supremacists of the violent type.
Yes, and they're Sunni Muslim oriented, generally.
There are a few Shia in Iran that would fall into this category, I think, too, wouldn't there?
That would be the second mortal enemy of America would be Iran.
This would get you to the nation states, yeah.
It's called a country, and it's called a government, it's called a state. I call it a terror organization that's pretending to be a government. And so, and that would be on the Shiite side. So those are the two mortal enemies and the two leading physical terror organizations that we have to confront. We sort of know how to confront Al-Qaeda, ISIS. We have very little understanding of how to confront Iran, so which bothers me. Anyways, that's one category. Then we have a second category of enemy, which I call frenemy, because they're partially friends and they're partially enemies, depending on the day, depending on the issue. In the frenemy category would be, these would be non-violent aggressors. This would be Turkey and Qatar, who are supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saudi Arabia, which is supporting the Wahhabis. So they're not blowing things up. In general, they're providing the ideology or the culture, so to speak, to encourage someone else to blow something up. And then we have a third category of enemy, which I would call adversary, actually, or competitor. Some people call enemies. It's a debatable issue. And that would be China and Russia. And where we have a huge ability to kill each other, but in general, we don't. I'd say, 99.9% of the time, we're not shooting at each other.
Ken, we have to pause for just a second. I want to come back to the cultural war that is also being waged against us on the other side of a very short break. Stay tuned for more with Ken Abramowitz right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Kenneth Abramowitz. He's a man who is expert in matters involving healthcare, but also national security, and not just in the form of old-fashioned kinetic warfare, but also the kind of, asymmetric warfare, some call it, cultural warfare and the like that we face in today's version of the war for the free world. And Ken, thank you very much for staying with us. I want you to sort of develop a little bit more fully the ways in which these enemies that you've identified engage in warfare against us besides you know, the violent jihad and periodic threats of other kinds of the physical sort.
Yes, sure. I monitor six forms of warfare. Physical war, which is obvious. Everybody involved monitors physical war. But I also monitor cultural war. In other words, you can fight with words. You don't have to just fight with bullets. You can fight with dollars. I call that economic war. You can fight with lawyers. I call that lawfare. You can fight with populations. I call that demographic warfare. And number six, cyber. And basically, our government is organized, and by the way, all democracies are organized to fight physical war and cyber war. Those are we sort of know what we're doing there. The problem is in the middle. We're not very good at cultural war. We have some abilities in economic war. We don't particularly understand lawfare. The bad guys do. We don't understand demographic war. And so we need help, basically. We, America, we, all democracies, need help integrating these six forms of warfare into our national security plans.
Our national security plans, as well as our threat assessments and our sort of operationalizing of those plans, are all part and parcel of what you're trying to raise the alarm about at SaveTheWest.com. And Ken, I guess I'd like you to further develop specifically kind of the importance in all of this of the assault on our, well, values, our culture, our civilization by those who seek to supplant us or force us to submit to their will, the top-down types, as you called them earlier on.
Okay, well, let's look at another way of looking at our enemies. And there's four enemies that, another a separate analysis, is four enemies that we're confronting. We, what I call normal people, democracies, roughly the one-third of the world, are fighting four forces simultaneously. One would be the Reds, the leftists, socialists, communists, progressives. They call different names in different countries. But basically, they're the status. They want the government to make all the decisions, control all the money. And they actually want to take us back into the past. They call themselves progressives. They're actually regressives who want to take us back 500 or 5,000 years in the past when the state made all the decisions. So that's a problem. Another simultaneous problem is the Islamists, which I also call political Islam, the politicization of a religion, which basically also wants to impose a top-down vision onto the population through religion or the politicization of a religion. And the Reds and the Greens, so to speak, are working together because they have a similar mindset. They both want the state to be powerful. They want the state to tell the individual how to behave, and they all have total disdain for the individual. And that's why they end up killing individuals, because they don't care about individuals. They care about this top-down approach, and all they care about is the welfare of the government, so to speak. And then a third enemy would be the globalists, which I call the blues, because of the color code of the United Nations, which symbolizes globalism, which doesn't recognize the rights of individual countries to govern themselves. The globalists, the UN, which we house in New York, I hate to say, or in the EU, which is in Brussels, basically wants to impose rules on countries, which then impose rules on individuals as to how they're supposed to behave. So it's another form of statist, so to speak. A little bit like the caliphate, so to speak. They don't care about individual countries. They just want the power to impose over us. And then you have a fourth group of people, which I color code white, the isolationists. They're color coded white for the surrender flag. These are not bad people. They're not evil people. They're not like the other three categories, which are evil. These are just normal people living in normal places, and you ask them a normal question about the normal country far away, and they say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Should we be fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Iran? They go, well, I think I know where those countries are. Can you tell me, please? And so they're not bad people. They're just, they're working hard. They're paying their mortgage. They're sending the kids to school. And they just don't spend a lot of time thinking about world events. And so, but they have a right to vote. So they vote for people who basically don't want to protect American national security interests. And so that's why I call them the fourth problem. Collectively, these four groups are two-thirds of the population, and that's why we're outnumbered. We're only one-third.
Inside the United States, you're talking about?
Yeah, but in general. If I were mushing the world together, this is roughly the way also the world is.
And what makes this particularly problematic is, of course, there's some overlap between the groups. The leftists are in the UN, for example, and there's also the coalitions or at least collaboration between these various elements. They may have their differences in terms of the end states they seek, but the red-green axis, I think, is to call that alliance between the left and the Islamists, for example, makes them much more formidable than they would be if you were dealing with them each individually and separately. Ken, I did want to, you mentioned Syria a moment ago. I wanted to come back to that because you had in your website, savethewest.com, and I commend it to our listeners. It's a terrific resource. You feature there your thoughts of the week. And one that caught my eye last week, I believe it was something you wrote in the aftermath of President Trump's decision to withdraw the remaining relatively small number of special forces that are on the ground in Syria. And as usual, you had some creative ideas about the upside, the silver lining, I think, as you put it, of this decision, with which I guess you don't entirely agree, but that there are some possible benefits. In fact, you've come up with some further benefits. Talk us through that, if you would.
Right. Okay. By the way, I like President Trump. I like the Trump administration, but that doesn't mean they're perfect. And so the Syrian decision, I thought, was a bad decision. And also, it wasn't fully vetted with the national security team. So it was a bad decision, and then the process was bad. So that upset me and others, too. And then I tried to think of what President Trump was thinking. And not that I called him, but just looking at some of the things he said subsequent to that, is he has an isolationist gene, so to speak, in his body, or his political base. My guess is the political base of the Republicans is two-thirds strong on national security, one-third that white category, the isolationists. Again, not bad people, they just don't know. And I think he has an element within him of whites, so to speak, of isolationism, and not because he's evil or bad or corrupt or any of those criticisms. He just has a world opinion that I think is just not in concert with the reality. So from his point of view, why is America fighting wars in the Middle East that are endless? Well, we've been fighting, we collectively, or Islam, has declared war on civilization for 1,400 years. So this is more endless than he thinks. So when you're in a 1,400-year war, the question is, do you want to fight another 1,400 years? Or do you want to stop the war? And how do you stop the war? Well, you stop the war by winning the war. You don't stop the war by pretending you're not in a war.
Or otherwise losing the war.
Right. Well, President Trump always says, we're going to win. We're winning every day. We're going to win so much, you're going to get tired of winning. Well, he, in effect, got tired of winning. That's the irony. And so he had a poor analysis of the situation. Now, the silver lining is that what he's in effect said to the people in the Middle East, both the good guys and the bad guys, that it's up to you to resolve your differences. I'm not sending wonderful kids from Kansas, 19-year-olds from Kansas, to resolve your differences. You've been fighting for 1,400 years. You figure it out. The Sunnis and Shiites hate each other. You figure it out. You either kill each other or learn how to live with each other. You know, years back, Catholics and Protestants used to kill each other. And then, after a lot of killing, 500 or whatever years of killing, they reached the agreement that, why don't we just let Catholics be Catholics and Protestants be Protestants, and we don't have to impose our vision of Christianity on each other. Okay, well, So in effect, what he's saying is, you guys figure it out. And then Muslims versus the Jews, you've been fighting for 1400, I'm putting words in President Trump's mouth, that you've been fighting for 1400 years, you figure it out. Either kill each other or figure out how to live with each other. I'd rather that you figure out how to live with each other. So the silver lining is that the Jews, Israel, and the Sunni Muslims will come to the obvious conclusion that they ought to work together much more closely and stop killing each other. I'm not saying every Sunni Muslim, but let's just say a lot of them, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states. Turkey's confused, so I'm not sure whether Turkey would be in that category. And basically work together to fight the Shiites until this government, in a corrupt government of criminals in Iran, is overthrown. But in the interim, let's work together and basically create a Jewish, Sunni Muslim NATO, so to speak, and confront Iran.
Kenneth Abramowitz, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a special pleasure to have with us for two segments a man that I have come to admire tremendously for both his service to our country in uniform and his considerable intellect and clarity of vision about the sorts of challenges that we're facing and what needs to be done about them, specifically from communist China and most especially in the domain known as 5G. His name is Brigadier General Robert Spalding, recently retired from the Air Force, where he was a special assistant to the Vice Chief of Staff, really the Air Force's duty expert on China, I think it's fair to say, for that matter, the Pentagon's. Also had served on the National Security Council for some time. He is a command pilot flying the B-2 stealth bomber in his distinguished career. He also served as the defense attaché in Beijing, vantage point from which he learned enormously about the challenges we'll be discussing with him in this part of the program. General Spalding, welcome back. It is so good to have you, sir. Happy New Year. Thank you for coming back on Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be back. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Let me ask you, sir, just to set the stage for this conversation, because we're going to get down into some brass tacks about what we're up against and what we need to do about it. But for starters, just sort of level setting, what is 5G? How should we understand what we're talking about in that space?
Well, I think it's better to talk about what 5G is not. And it's a misnomer, really, because it conveys the idea that it's an incremental upgrade from 4G, like 3G to 4G. 4G to 5G is fundamentally different. You rather have to look at it almost like rebuilding the way we connect to the internet through wireless networks. And there's a number of technologies and number of capabilities that are part of 5G that change the way that we interact with the internet. But more importantly, it really fundamentally opens the door for machines to connect to the network and use the network in a way that machines need to. The technologies that are most talked about are MIMO and beamforming. MIMO means massive multiple input, multiple output. And what that means is essentially you have multiple antennas, both at the base stations and in the devices that are connected. And this allows for a resiliency of the connection and multiple connections to form to get the best essential connection that you can. The other is called beamforming, and this is really electronic steering of the signal so that rather than having a broadcast like 4G has, it's more of like a pencil beam that goes to your device. Now, this is interesting, and one of the reasons why a millimeter wave or high band network is so dense, because essentially the network has to have line of sight to your phone because millimeter wave won't pass through the human body. So, you know, whereas a 4G network that would typically have 90 stations in a build out, a high band or millimeter wave network will have about 1,200. So it's a far more dense network. The other thing it does is it allows you to cobble together pieces of spectrum to make a more fulsome network. And what that means is, if you think of spectrum like real estate, for a good 5G network, you need about 100 megahertz of bandwidth. And in the past, in the way these wireless networks were deployed, that bandwidth needed to be consecutive or continuous. In other words, if you're thinking about this in terms of real estate, if you're buying a piece of property and somebody had something that sat in the middle and wouldn't sell, then you couldn't make a 5G network using old technology. But 5G actually advances it and allows you to cobble together pieces of spectrum to make that 100 megahertz. So you can have, say, 40 megahertz in one place, 10 megahertz in another, and another 40 in another place, and cobble together a 90 megahertz spectrum. And so, and then finally, the way the network can be sliced or divided allows for the formation of private networks. And so if you have a large corporate enterprise, say like General Motors, and you want to form your own private network, you're no longer required to build the hardware to do that. The 5G implementation will allow you to actually divide into a private network that only you and your employees can use. So there's a number of interesting capabilities that are all part of 5G. And finally, what that means in terms of the devices that are connected to the network is that you're going to have very low latency. And that is absolutely required for things like remote surgery devices, where a doctor can perform surgery over the network through a robotic arm to another location. Remote driving cars, that low latency, about a millisecond, is absolutely required so that you could have that kind of fine detail when things are actually could be perilous to humans. Also, the speed is about 20 gigahertz. And then most importantly, and this is really where the idea of smart cities comes from, you're going to be able to bring the city to life, because today's implementation of 4G only allows you to connect about 10,000 devices per square mile. Now, you really get this effect when you're in a stadium and you can't get a connection through to the internet on your cell phone. What 5G allows you to do is connect 3 million devices per square mile. So if you think about it in a security sense, you have just exploded the threat landscape.
Yeah. All right. So let me come back to that in just a moment. But just to level set, General, you've given us a lot of interesting statistics and detail. But for the layperson, what I hear you saying is this is a fifth generation communications capability that will be orders of magnitude more powerful than the fourth generation, let alone the third generation, and enable through a variety of means of radio transmission and spectrum usage and networking capabilities for particularly connecting machines to other machines to share information, data, to do things remotely or otherwise that are simply beyond our capacity today. And you've talked about some of the capabilities of self-driving cars and remote surgery and the like that might be made possible through this sort of technology, bringing the city to life, as you say, an internet of things. These are concepts that I suspect most of us are now beginning to get some sense of, but could you just, for example, drill down in this Internet of Things? What exactly would that involve, and how would it affect the lives of ordinary folks?
Well, actually, you're starting to see some of the implementation of this currently in China, where you, for instance, you'll make an order on your phone on WeChat and you'll walk into the restaurant. The restaurant will have cameras in the restaurant that recognize your face as you walk in the door. The customer service attendant will greet you by your name and hand you your order. So you can expect that cities will have cameras, speakers, you'll have drones doing delivery, you'll have robots that can clean the streets. You'll even probably have, you know, robots maybe that can provide neighborhood security. And, you know, really the applications of a smart city are endless. And I think that's the, you know, rather than thinking of it as 5G, you know, I like to think of it as Internet 2.0. And it really is a reimagination of the connected world and how humans interact with machines in a connected world. That's what 5G will enable. And that's why a lot of the, you know, when I look at what innovation is going to come with this Internet 2.0, you know, the first iteration was really about software development. I think what you're going to see is a large expansion of hardware development as people come up with new and unique machines that connect to the network to, you know, create new business models that they can earn money on, but also to make, you know, our lives better.
Yeah. Quality of life. Quality of life is a big selling point here. But General, you are first and foremost a national security guy. You've spent decades in uniform, the United States Air Force, served with great distinction both in the cockpit and in places like what I think of as the front lines of the war for the free world in Beijing. What you have also helped me understand, and I want to have you share a bit with our audience as well, and some of it will be on the other side of a short break, but there are real risks associated with this Internet 2.0 and the various capabilities that you've described that have the potential, of course, to make our lives substantially better, but that also could be used against us, perhaps even weaponized, literally, to endanger our lives, not just make them materially less comfortable and so on. For this reason, you have placed an enormous amount of emphasis, and I think properly so, on having a secure 5G network in the United States. And when we come back, General, I want you to talk a little bit about how we can ensure that not only are we still competitive, if not dominant, certainly competitive in this domain, but also we're going to protect ourselves against the potential abuse of a 5G system by enemies like China. We'll talk about all of that and much more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our second installment of another very important conversation with General Rob Spalding, recently retired as a Brigadier General from the United States Air Force. His rank, I think, substantially understates his influence and his impact in uniform, and now that he's taken it off in the private sector as well. We're always delighted to catch up with him, especially because he's been doing really serious thinking about and work on the 5G competition that is underway at the moment, perhaps only for a short while longer. But General, when we were speaking earlier, you sort of set the stage for us about the stakes here, the importance, the contribution 5G could make to a better standard of living for Americans and, for that matter, country. You've also enumerated a few of the risks. Talk to us about what we need to be doing to make sure that we have, in fact, a 5G network that will serve the interests of our country and not one that will be, perhaps weaponized against us in various ways by the Chinese or others.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. I think there's two things that we need to be concerned about with regard to the current state of play with 5G. And one is the ability for the Chinese Communist Party to do massive surveillance, not just in the United States, but globally, as they basically look to essentially dominate the market share for 5G implementation around the world. And the next thing that we need to be concerned about is the ability for them to weaponize those smart cities against the populace in the case that they need or there arises some crisis. So, you know, the challenge here is that most of the equipment manufacturer has gone to China now. And so one of their strategies that they have used is essentially to offer the equipment at a deep discount. Now, this puts pressure on the carriers. And so typically the carriers are the ones that are going to the governments and lobbying them to allow them to put Huawei in. And as you know, and has been reported, it is that ability to affect the supply chain where you can basically insert back doors to allow you to either spy or take control of the devices or the machines that are connected to the network. And the things that we thought about doing and as I was working on this strategy was to roll out in the United States a secure 5G network in the mid-band and do it very, very quickly. In fact, what we talked about, and I talked to all the equipment manufacturers in the space that aren't Chinese, and I asked them, you know, worked with their engineers on what was the best way to do this. And the conclusion we came to is if you could build a nationwide network in 3 years here in the United States and you build it securely so that you could prevent the devices that were connected to the network from being hacked and that you could encrypt the data that was going across the network to prevent surveillance, that the speed that you deployed that network would then allow for the reintroduction of manufacturing for microelectronics here in the United States. So you would be able to secure the supply chain, in other words, the hardware that was being manufactured to put on this network, and you could actually secure the network itself with a new non-computer processing unit-based computing technology, which right now the CPU or the computer processing unit is completely a corrupted environment because the CPU and the operating systems were never designed for security. They were designed for connectedness and speed. And so when you don't design something for security in the beginning, you have what we have today, which is an application of cybersecurity over the top, which is in effect, you know, not really providing security as we found, you know, with the millions of records that we see we're losing every day and the constant hacks that we're running into. So build a secure network that's designed from its foundation to be secure, and then offer that to the American people, offer it to our industrial companies, offer it to our government agencies, offer it to our financial institutions, offer it to our social media companies to prevent stealing of financial data, the influence in our social media companies, and to prevent the stealing of our sensitive industrial secrets from our industrial companies.
Well, this sounds so sensible. One wonders why it hasn't been done before, but the real concern is that it won't be done now. And one of the things I wanted you to just drill down on, and if you would, General Spaulding, is apparently a key piece of whether we could do this, whether we could indeed proceed with an indigenous secure 5G network as an alternative, whether we will be able to, in fact, achieve this kind of 5G secure, resilient network depends upon something called spectrum, and specifically whether there will be an ability to gain access to the Defense Department's part of the electromagnetic spectrum and use it in a manner that would not be, you know, incompatible with their missions, which are vital, obviously, but make possible something vital to the nation as a whole. Could you talk us through that, please?
So I think the allocation of spectrum here in the United States is not really conducive to to doing anything fast. It takes 13 years on average to clear and sell spectrum. More importantly, when anybody buys spectrum, they allocate billions of dollars to just purchase a spectrum. When that happens, the money that they require to build the network, quite frankly, is not there. So they typically have to wait until they have the money available to then build the spectrum. And that so often they're looking ahead maybe 10 years to acquire the spectrum and then wait for until the financial status is good so that they can actually do the build out. The problem today is that, the only two carriers that have nationwide spectrum are Verizon and Sprint. Verizon has it in the high band. And as I said before, that is really only for urban areas because it's a very dense deployment. It doesn't work for rural areas and really making a nationwide network. And so, you're going to see 5G roll out in the cities, but not really be nationwide in a way that you could have self-driving cars go across the United States. Now, Sprint does have spectrum in the mid-band, but doesn't necessarily have the capital, and T-Mobile as well may not have the capital to really build that network out in less than, say, 10 years. And so it's a combination of the fact that we don't have spectrum. Now, it is possible with 5G, as I was saying before, I didn't talk about this. This is another capability that 5G offers. It allows you to, because of MIMO and beamforming that I talked about, it allows you to create networks that are that can dual use spectrum. So you can have many users of the same spectrum that you can eliminate interference using technology. And so it is possible now to essentially reuse spectrum that may be, certainly today used for another purpose, say, for instance, radars or satellite communications with 5G without interfering. And so one way that you could possibly do this is to, say, take some spectrum from some federal agency. DOD is one. There's others that have spectrum, and say, we're going to share that spectrum with a network provider that would build the network and very rapidly deploy it. And yet the DOD would not have to relinquish or sell that spectrum. It would retain ownership. It would just grant use, or say, for rather than like a sale, think of it more like a lease, and be compensated in terms of perhaps the federal government wouldn't, or the DOD wouldn't be required to pay for use of that network once it was built as a condition of being able to share their spectrum.
Yeah. Listen, there are so many aspects of this that we need to further tease out, Rob Spalding, and we've only sort of scratched the surface here. I want to thank you for taking the time to do that with me today. But I hope you'll come back and do some further explication of this. General Spalding, again, thank you for both your service to our country in uniform in the past and that you're rendering today. I appreciate so much your time as your expertise, and we'll look forward to talking to you often in 2019. Look forward to talking to the rest of you again next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.